Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Cesternino here, and I have some bonus coverage about this week's Survivor, and this is some coverage that's not going to deal specifically too much with the episode of Survivor from this week, which I know really stirred up a lot of emotion in people. We've done a lot of coverage so far between the know-it-alls with Shannon Gates, and then the recap with Kelly Wentworth, and then the supersized feedback show where we talked with the First Lady of Podcasting. We talked with Dr. Amanda Rabinowitz and with Sarah Channon. But what I wanted to do was segue a little bit from what happened specifically and how it pertains to Survivor to at least expand the conversation a little bit more to what can we take away from what happened on Survivor and bring that into the real world. So we are going to talk with two separate people that both work at universities, and both of them work in sexual violence prevention and education at two different colleges, and they don't know each other. First, we're going to talk with Tori, who is from Victoria, Canada. And then later on in this podcast, we're going to actually hear from a gentleman, Lemoyne, who works at a university covering this sort of thing. And we're going to hear from both of them some perspective in terms of how we can take what was happening on Survivor this week and sort of the awareness around this subject, and then how are we going to be able to better address these issues when they come up in the real world. While we will talk about the Survivor episode to some degree here in this podcast, we'll be back talking about the episode a bit more in the Wiggle Room this week, where Josh Wiggler and I are going to be joined by a reporter, Lily Herman, who had a piece that ran in Us magazine, and we'll also have a This Week in Survivor where Nick Iadanza is going to join Jordan Kalish and myself to talk about things and talk about the This Week in Survivor history quiz. So while we still will have some conversation about the actual Survivor episode here today, that's not my primary focus here with these guests. I really just want to continue this conversation that we've had around the episode and just bring it back to this conversation and how it expands beyond just Survivor. So let me bring in our first guest here today for this special podcast. She had reached out to me in the aftermath of a Wednesday night's episode. She is a longtime Survivor viewer and podcast listener. She also works at a university in sexualized violence prevention, education, and support. I want to welcome Tori from Victoria to the podcast. Tori, how are you?
I am doing well. Thanks so much for having me and talking about this issue in such detail. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, Tori, I wanted to sort of like, okay, we're talking so much about, you know, this conversation and specifically like how it pertains to Survivor, but I wanted to also talk a little bit about how we can make the leap to taking the conversation a little bit more outside of Survivor to, you know, hopefully have some, you know, positive results out of all of this ugliness this week. But before we talk about that, I just wanted to get your take on the situation as a Survivor fan.
Totally. Like, obviously, it was very difficult to watch, and I kind of felt trapped in watching it. I think that a lot of people can relate to kind of what happened because it's very common in workplaces, at universities. Obviously, that's where I work, and in just daily interactions with people that you know and also bump into. And so I felt it was very difficult to watch. I'm glad that the conversation is continuing, because we often find with different things on TV, like there's an initial conversation and then it kind of dies down. So I really am hoping that this brings about change in people's viewpoints or mindsets about what's really going down. But yeah, it was extremely difficult to watch. And yeah, my heart goes out to Kelly and Jamal and Janet and all those people impacted.
Tori, how did you feel like the show did in terms of the response, and what sort of would a proper response look like in the real world?
Totally. So in terms of the game and the TV show, it's been challenging. I think that it's very common in everyday life to use language that can diminish like a survivor's experience. And I think we've seen that kind of throughout
I know that we're using a word that has kind of two meanings in this this universe, but we're talking about a survivor of a sexual harassment or assault.
Totally.
In that not a survivor contestant.
Totally, and I'm glad that you brought that up because that's really what I'm getting at. Is I choose to use the word survivor, and that's kind of typically in the world that I work in, what folks use, because it empowers their survivor and doesn't put them in a place of like victimhood. So I'm talking about survivors in terms of they've experienced some type of sexual harassment. But I think that, sometimes the news coverage can diminish their experience by using terms like alleged, and we've kind of seen that. I think that it's very difficult to produce a TV show when this is going on, but I believe that everyone has the right to live free of sexual harassment. So I don't know what I would have done if I was in the shoes of the producers, but I have maybe some thoughts.
Yeah, go ahead. I'd love to hear them.
Totally. I think like, what I would hope is that someone would have intervened earlier. Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen, like we saw, and I think it was episode one, Kelly speaking to Dan, laying his head on her legs and talking about it in a confessional, and then approaching him on the beach and saying like, hey, I don't like that. And she used the example that she was a germaphobe in that case. And I think one thing that we have to consider is that sometimes people will use those examples to kind of soften the blow, and we have to listen to them and respect them any which way they want to tell us. So I think that I would have hoped that someone could see that this is impacting Kelly's game and mental health and like livelihood and would intervene. With that being said, oftentimes in the work that I do, we try to come from it from a survivor-centered approach. So really asking the survivor what they want to do. And again, I'm using survivor in the terms of someone that's experienced sexualized violence.
We got you.
Okay, cheers. Really what kind of the viewpoint from that is that someone's power has been taken away, and how can we empower them? We can give them choice, voice, and control of the situation, and ask them what they want to do, because it's different for everyone. And I think that it's very complex in this situation because it's really hard to do that in the real world, to say what you want or to approach that person. But this would be even harder to make like a clear decision when you have these social implications, because we often see survivors, if they come forward, they get iced out from groups. They, you know, lose that reference letter that they've been working on. They lose their job or social position. So I think that in that case, like I would have had a more direct conversation with her. I appreciated that producer we saw in this last episode who asked her like, kind of, what do you want to do? But I still think it was kind of like beating around the bush. And I think that people, we need to communicate better. And again, like we learn from what we get, which is kind of lackluster sex ed, and we all have a tough time communicating to each other. So I think one takeaway is just really being more direct with people. If you think that someone needs help, be honest with them, tell them where you're coming from, and just be more direct with them. So I think like it would have been helpful if the producers were more direct. And maybe this happened, obviously, in a different confessional that they didn't show us, because I'm sure that there was many, many conversations like this, but I think that that's one thing that we can do better.
Tori, we didn't see any of the producer meetings that were on the show. Do you think that not filming those was helpful or not helpful for this whole experience?
I think it's probably not helpful because I think that they probably don't do a great job. Like, they're there to produce TV. They probably are not educated maybe in how to handle a delicate situation like this. And like, we saw this on The Bachelor. It was The Bachelor in Paradise season maybe two summers ago.
Yes.
Where a similar thing happened and they definitely filmed some of it, but not all of it.
Yeah. Well, that was, I would say, in this category, but I wouldn't say it was necessarily
exactly
a similar situation, because that was
totally
where one of the Bachelor, from what I do enjoy Bachelor in Paradise, but I may have the facts wrong. One of the contestants was overserved and then
totally
was, you know, engaged in sexual acts with another contestant, and she was passed out, I believe, and they had to. That's a whole, you know, different.
That's a whole can of worms.
Right.
I totally appreciate
yes
that. But yeah, it was. So I think that it's kind of a similar situation where I don't know if it would have been better to tape it or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I only ask because I wonder that if somebody is talking about how they feel, might they be less likely to say how they really feel if they're on the record versus off the record?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I'm sure that's the case for some people.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Yeah.
Tori, in the work that you do, do you find that more of the people that come into you at the university, are they people who that they have had sort of like what we think of with the an experience like the traditional, you know, definition of like a sexual assault? Or do you find that there are a lot of people that come in that are in this area that was sort of explored in the Survivor episode where there's unwanted touching, but
totally
it was not, you know, a clear cut flag. Okay, this is, you know, this person is definitely in the wrong, where the person who is the perpetrator can say, oh, what? I didn't even know that happened. I had no idea.
Totally. Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought this up because that's like a really good point. Mostly people, yeah, will disclose when something has happened to them, like sexual assault, because it's such a clear and recognizable example of sexualized violence. So when I say recognizable, I mean generally the population knows that that is wrong, where there's this kind of, we look at it in my office as a pyramid, where there's these layers of behavior that are little less recognized, way more common, like inappropriate non-consensual touching, which is what we saw in this episode, that go unchecked. And these kind of behaviors are the foundation of like the system that kind of upholds sexualized violence. So if you look at it as a pyramid, on the bottom, you would have attitudes and beliefs. So basically, it's where one group feels entitled to something, or they're placed with more like high regard or more value than another group. So that's sexism, which was a clear example, racism, homophobia, transphobia, ableism, anything like that. And so there's the attitudes on the bottom, attitudes and beliefs, and then like you mentioned before, touching, inappropriate touching, that kind of leads or makes it acceptable for those more extreme behaviors to occur. So we're talking about like sexual assault. So those are the highly recognizable, egregious acts that basically everyone can get on the same page that they're wrong. But where we have the power to intervene is really at the bottom of the pyramid with our attitudes and beliefs, and maybe those sexist jokes or comments that kind of go unchecked. Like, that's really where we can intervene, so we can dismantle the entire system that sexualized violence operates within.
for anybody who is listening to the podcast and, you know, finds themselves in that type of situation. And I want to be just very clear of that, you know, we're not only talking about women, because I have heard from a number of the male listeners who have, you know, been through this type of experience where that they have been on the receiving end of, you know, unwanted touching from another person.
Totally.
What is the right recommendation of that? Are you saying that the first thing you should do is to be direct with the person that is doing the inappropriate touching? Or do you feel like that it's best for a person to go to a third party, whether it's HR or some sort of, you know, other person who is, you know, a supervisor or some other assistance?
Yeah, so I really want to tread lightly with my answer on this, and that's because it's just so individual to what the person wants to do. A lot of people want to disclose incidents to family, friends, partners, colleagues, anyone that they trust and that they identify as a safe ally. So that could just be a trusting friend, or it could be like a resident advisor in the context that I work in or anything like that. And really, again, what we want to do is check in with the survivor and see what they want to do. I don't have a particular right answer for that because it really depends for them. I think what happens is that systems have failed survivors in terms of like a judicial system or police in a lot of cases. So often they feel like they don't have power to get support from those systems. I think that people are scared of the fallout if they were to tell a supervisor or anything like that. So I think there is no right way. I think whatever the person decides to do is the right thing for them, because I would never want to, if the person directly approaches the person that's enacting these harms and they don't stop, we don't want to blame them and say like, well, you talked to them and then like it didn't help. So we never want to put the blame on the victim. It's never their fault. So it depends on what they want to do. So that's, I think this is a roundabout way of just saying that if you were on the receiving end of like inappropriate behaviors, do what's best for you. Seek help from a counselor if you're in a position like that. Speak to a friend or family member, someone that you trust, to get the support. I hope that that person would support them either way.
Yeah.
It's not for us to dictate what they should do. If they don't want to go to the police, if they don't want to tell their boss, they don't want to tell their teacher, anything like that, we support that. If we think that there's a risk to themselves or other people, that's when we might intervene and see if we could call a third party if you think there's a risk. But I believe that it's the survivor's story to tell. So unless you think that there's no risk, you should keep the secret yourself or keep the story yourself and explore options with them. But follow their lead and respect whichever decision they want to make.
Tori, I think that for a lot of the people that might go through something like this, I think that there is probably some self-doubt of like, was this wrong? Like, am I being, being dramatic about this? Is this really happening? Are there any resources that are online that people could talk to somebody else who would be able to tell them like, but based on what you're describing, that's definitely an issue.
Totally. I think, again, we're not here to police survivors' experiences. If they feel like they've been harmed, then we believe them. And if they don't, then that's cool too. For example, there's a famous picture called a Girl in Italy or something on the lines of that. It's taken in the 50s. She's a model walking down the street, and there's a bunch of people that we assume are perpetrating sexualized violence by like leering, whistling, blocking her clear path down the sidewalk, anything like that. Later, it came out during the kind of rise of the Me Too movement that she felt confident and great in that situation. So again, we're not here. Mm-hmm. One situation for some people might feel like a harm. Sometimes it doesn't. So I think what I would suggest for people is definitely look online, especially where you live, of what maybe falls under that category if you think that you may have been harmed, because there probably is behaviors that you aren't as sure about. It's not as clearly kind of recognizable, like we talked about sexual assault. So, but basically anything that's done without your consent when you're put in a vulnerable position could be considered sexual harassment. So we're talking about inappropriate jokes about like your sex life, or digging deep into that if you're like colleagues, or leering at someone, like catcalling is street harassment. So yeah, but it depends on the person again. And I get that my answers maybe aren't clear. And I think that just shows that it really is, I think, okay. Sorry, Rob. It's tough.
You don't need to apologize that this is complicated.
I think that there are behaviors that are inappropriate when they're non-consensual, and there's no, people always say there's a gray area. It's like, for me, there's no gray area. If it's non-consensual, it's unacceptable. But we have to take the lead of the person who's experiencing these things.
We're talking a bit about from the perspective of the person who we're talking about as the survivor. What about for the people who are the confidant of the survivor? How do you react when you might be the person who, you know, gets the phone call from your friend who's totally upset and says, hey, I want to tell you about this situation that I'm dealing with?
Totally. I think the first thing to do is just empathize and state that you believe them and that you are so sorry that something like this happened to them. Often survivors think that they won't be believed, and that it's up to them to do something. So basically just say like, I'm here to listen. I believe your story. Thank you so much for telling me that this happened. And I'm so sorry that this happened. Those are kind of easy sentence starters to use. You can choose your own words, obviously. But those are some great things to say. One thing also, at the university that I work at, we use trauma-informed practices. And basically that just means that we assume that everyone can carry trauma and that we have to be delicate with the way we move around things. So basically, what I would say next is don't ask them questions about details that you don't need. So just before you ask them a question, check in with yourself. Is that information that I need, or is that information, do you know what I'm saying with that? Like, it just make sure that if you're going to get them to tell you something about this experience, that it's something that you either need to make a decision if you're going to go to a third party and tell them what happened, but you don't need to ask details that they don't want to provide to you. So sometimes you're curious about what happened, and that's fair, but really only asking them questions about what they need and how they want to proceed is really the best practice. And then I would say, again, follow their lead or research options if you guys are both stuck. And then I think the last kind of piece is that continuously follow up with them and make sure they're okay, and take care of yourself, because it can be really tough to hear these stories, and it might bring things up for you. So just make sure that you are also taking care of yourself.
Tori, I know one of the other things that we wanted to cover here today had to do with consent, and I'm gonna generalize that I think that most people know what that means in terms of having a physical relationship with
totally.
People. I'm hoping.
Yeah.
But what about? In that it came up in the episode, like, hey, I can't help if I'm, bumping into people. We live in a tiny shelter. Like, these types of things just happen. It's we're just bumping into each other.
Totally. And that's not an excuse to touch anyone without their permission. So I think often when we talk about consent, we're thinking about sexual activities, but really we can apply the same standard to our everyday lives. So just a quick recap for folks. Consent means that there's a voluntary agreement to engage and continue to engage in an activity or physical contact. And I think that there's lots of areas in our life that we can kind of infuse consent and respect into our practice. For example, in living in close quarters, like before you move something of someone's or before you touch someone or borrow something, like just asking. And I think that that seems so simple, but often goes like overlooked. So I think that's the exact same thing. Chrissy from Heroes, Hustlers, and Healers, that's probably wrong, from Triple H, mentioned that there was a challenge where she was going to have to be hoisted up into the air. And one of her tribe mates, I believe it was Alan, checked in with her, hey, is it okay if I do this?
Yeah.
And I think it's the role of the initiator.
Yeah. He also patted down JP for an idol and told him to take his underwear off.
And I think that that's like another thing to talk about is these things are so complex. We have Jamal being so so right on the mark talking about gender in Survivor and elsewhere. But you see him shutting down Kelly when she wants to try to make the fire. Like, we're steeped in these historical contexts that, like, this is how we're socialized. This is how we have grown up. And I think that that's something to recognize, that we can all do better. We can all reflect on our own behavior. And even if it's not your intention to harm somebody, you have to take responsibility and accountability for that. We often use, it's not an ideal example, but like a car crash. If you crash into someone else's car, you don't mean to harm them. Obviously, you don't want to hurt them. But once you do that, you do whatever you need to do to make it right, right? So that's kind of if you accidentally, if you touch someone and you didn't mean to, because that happens all the time. Like, if you're comforting someone, or like with my colleague leaned in the other day and I touched his shoulder without asking, because it's just an automatic thing that we grow up with. So I think what it is just reflecting on our behavior and seeing how we can just not make assumptions, I guess, and just consider everything before we do something. I think that's the thing. We just need to be more mindful of what we're doing.
Tori, where should the conversation go next in terms of like the broader conversation that people are having about this subject? Where should we go from here?
I would hope that people take this back into their real lives and talk to their peers and their friends and their family about what happened and how that they would like to move forward. And I think it's really important that people educate themselves on these topics, because there's a lot of myths that need to be busted around sexualized violence. So I think what you can do is role model these consensual behaviors, because people will take note and appreciate it. Talk to your friends and family about what happened. Take care of yourself. If you think that this could, if this brings up something that maybe you've enacted harm, take accountability, reflect on your behavior, educate yourself, apologize if you can, and then move forward. And I think we just need to reflect on some of these behaviors don't allow people to thrive. I see it at the university all of the time where people, it takes a long time for people to heal from incidents like this. So we just want everyone to live in a safe way, free of any of this type of unfair and unacceptable behaviors.
All right, Tori, thank you so much for all your contributions in this conversation. I know that it's going to mean a lot to many of our listeners. And so I really appreciate you taking some time to talk about all this and educate us a little bit more on this subject.
Totally. I super appreciate it. I want to end this by just saying that I am in no means an expert. I work in sexualized violence prevention efforts, but we all have a lot to learn. A lot of these behaviors are socialized, which isn't an excuse, but it's just a way to really take an account for how we contribute and how we can contribute in a positive way and be good allies for those that have been affected. And if we are doing that, then people may come forward with their stories, and that's when we can really be of support to people. So I think that, yeah, I just want to clarify that everyone has a lot of learning to do, including myself. It's an ongoing process to consider all of these things that have been so ingrained in our current culture. And I'm happy to engage in any conversation that anyone would like to talk about.
Tori, if people want to reach out to you, what's the best way that people can contact you?
Yeah, I'll give my email, TORRYAHARRIS@gmail.com, because most of my public accounts are attached to my podcast, which might not be the most appropriate way. So I'm happy to provide my email, and I can point people in the right direction if they're seeking assistance, further education, or just someone to chat with.
Okay. Do you want to plug the podcast?
Yeah, you might have seen my Twitter for my podcast, Ready to Be Petty. And I'm just saying that here because I've been having conversations with people online already, and so I'm happy for you to jump in on those. But this is in no means a way to promote my podcast.
Yes, no, I appreciate that. I would, if people want to follow what you're doing, I would love for them to follow it. But yeah, that's not the primary focus of why you're here.
Absolutely. And yeah, I appreciate you mentioning that. But yeah, that's where people will find me online having these conversations already.
Great. Tori, thank you so much. And I know that speaking on behalf of the listeners, I know we really appreciate you taking some time to talk about all of this.
Yeah. And I so appreciate that you are not letting this episode pass by and really taking the opportunity to use your platform for good. Like I really appreciate how open and honest you've been about this episode and willing to dig a little deeper. I appreciate that so, so much.
Well, I, you know, am so much, you know, in this world and with, you know, this community of people that love the show. And I just, you know, I realized, like, you know, how many people that this, you know, either, you know, opened up old wounds or, you know, created
totally
fresh wounds for people. And I just want to, you know, help bring some comfort to people and awareness around this issue so that, you know, something positive can come out of this ugliness.
Yeah. Yeah. And I appreciate that so much because often we shy away from these conversations, and that really is a great place to start, is just engaging in dialogue. So I super appreciate that.
You got it, Tori. Thank you so much. And thanks again to Tori for all of her contributions on this conversation. I also want to point you to Another great resource that Lita Brillman ended up talking with Taryn Armstrong, that Taryn did a Twitch stream the other night. If you want to go and check that out, you can access that at twitch.tv/Taryn Armstrong. And now I want to bring you the second part of this podcast, where I ended up speaking with another great resource. Here is my conversation with Lemoyne. I want to bring in our second guest here today to talk about this. And we've heard from so many smart, articulate women on this subject. And I was very eager to also get the perspective of a man to talk about this subject as well. And he emailed me, I don't even know if the episode was over yet, but he emailed me during within minutes of the end of the show on Wednesday night, and said, I am someone who works in sexual violence education at a college, and I want to help talk about some of the things that were going on in the episode. So I want to welcome Lemoyne to the conversation. Lemoyne, how are you?
How's it going, Rob? Unfortunately, you know, you have some smart, articulate women talking about this topic. You know, I am a man. I'm not sure if I'm smart or articulate, but I'll do my best. All right.
Okay. But I thought that it was also important to get the perspective of a man who works in this area as well, because I think that maybe there might be a portion of the audience who might, maybe in the form of a different messenger, might be, you know, a little more receptive, or you might have a different perspective to be able to talk about everything that we saw from the other night.
Absolutely. That's kind of why I'm employed.
Yeah. Okay. Can you talk a little bit about what it is that you do in your day job?
Sure. So currently, like Rob said, I work at a college where I work in sexual violence prevention education. I like to add that word prevention in there.
Sure.
Because, you know, that's what we're trying to stop. But yeah, so essentially I work with student athletes, fraternity sorority students on how they can take some tangible skills in terms of how they can be, you know, better bystanders or just better educators within their communities on how they can end violence, you know, in whatever community they're a part of.
Would you say that the infrastructure around a university is set up at all like the infrastructure around a reality show production, where there are a lot of people who are sort of running things, that it might be similar or dissimilar in any way?
Yeah, I definitely would say so, right? Because you definitely have all these different stakeholders, regardless of whether you're talking about faculty, staff, students, and also particular types of students. So like I said, I work with, you know, student athletes and fraternity sorority students. But yeah, there are definitely different stakeholders and different, like, I think, positions of power within colleges that definitely can, I've saw a lot translating between that and, you know, the context of Survivor, which is odd, but It's true. It mirrors real life.
Okay. Lemoyne, did you have anything in particular about the actual episode that you feel like has not been talked about in these last couple of days, or has not gotten a lot of attention?
I think one thing, so one of the reasons why I, like you said, like I reached out to you while the episode was happening, which is true, is because there's this idea of false accusations, which really just like stood out to me. It's one of the things that I always talk about a lot, both in my job, but also now outside of my job. I think oftentimes when we're talking about issues of sexual violence, we are looking at it through the perspective of how it affects, you know, men, right? And you saw that a lot on the episode in terms of the castaways are talking about, you know, the negative impact that could have on someone like Dan for the rest of their lives. And that leads to this idea of talking about how people can be falsely accused of committing acts of sexual misconduct, sexual violence, all that good fun stuff, right? And so one of the things that I really just wanted to make sure that was known to the audience, at least, is that like false accusations are very, very rare. They happen, at least the FBI reports, they happen between 2-8% of the time. And a lot of qualitative studies, a lot of studies show that it happens closer to 2% for a lot of reasons that I won't get into, but if you're interested, you can feel free to reach out to me afterwards. And so I think one of the things is that when we're talking about false accusations, it's often used as a way to further silence someone, and further silence or discredit their story because, oh, wait, no, they're probably lying in order to get a benefit, right? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that was unique to Survivor in this case is that, at least when talking about like Missy and Elizabeth, for example, there is an active reward component to Survivor where exaggerating their story for the purpose of aligning themselves with Kelly, there's an actual purpose to them exaggerating a claim that is still true that they may feel, but they may not feel uncomfortable because it allows them to bond with Kelly in order for them to feel uncomfortable, right?
Yeah.
But in the real world, there's rarely ever a reward to lying about a story. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
There's not $1 million at the end of the day if someone chooses to lie or exaggerate details about their story. There's nothing like that.
In this scenario, yes, that we saw Missy and Elizabeth embellish their claim and misrepresent what had happened and how they felt. But it was almost that the opposite, that they kind of did that for Dan's benefit. I know it sounds backwards, but they lied to the woman who first brought forth the charges to make her feel safer. But in terms of they did, it's not like they went to production and said, hey, this is happening with this other contestant, and it wasn't really happening. So it's also like kind of convoluted in terms of where the falsehoods were in that.
Right. Absolutely. It's like,
you know, they weren't trying to get an innocent person kicked out of the game. They were trying to make the initial accuser feel safer so they could vote her out.
Yes. Or at the very least, like, as a way to like bond with them. I'm talking about like the first, I was also talking about like the first hour in particular. Like it was a way to like bond with Kelly at the beginning of the, is a way to like bond for Kelly, or at the very least, like, yes. And after a while, once the episode proceeded to continue, it was a way to like soothe her as a way in order to, you're right, vote her out right afterwards. And then the second hour, it was kind of just a way to like continue to foster like that relationship with Dan. So all in all, I think the point I'm trying to say is like this dynamic is unique because there is like an active reward component that like they can see, and they're trying to strive for, again, $1 million at the end of the day. Something that everyone can have, like, can see that tangible benefit that they're going to see affect their lives, the lives of their loved ones. So like there is some incentive to do that on Survivor that isn't as persistent in real life. In terms of like the thing I like to pose to students when they bring up the idea of false accusations is like, name someone who's ever really become famous for falsely accusing someone. And you can't think of one, right? It's rare. But a lot of our conversations surrounding sexual violence are centered on this idea, or at least when we're trying to discredit someone, is centered on the idea of they're probably lying because they want to benefit someone else. They want to reap some benefits from this, or they're probably just trying to do blah, blah, blah. That goes into this myth of false accusations happening regularly. They're very rare occurrence. They happen as much or as little as other false accusations for any other crime in terms of a burglary, a robbery, things like that. And so I just want to make sure that like that's known to the audience. It's like, yeah, false accusations don't happen that regularly. And like, I think one of the things that I want to make sure we're conscious of when continuing this conversation, at least expanding this conversation outside the realm of Survivor, is to make sure that we're being mindful of the fact that, again, false accusations in terms of sexual violence are no more than any other false accusations for any other crime.
One of the things I wanted to do was to try to pick up the conversation where Jamal left things off at that tribal council from the other night. And so if you don't mind, I'd like to set up the clip of Jamal and then have you respond and also add anything else that you would like to what Jamal had to say. This is from the second tribal council on Wednesday night.
And Jamal, part of the reason this is complicated is because right now we are going through such a seismic cultural shift in how men and women relate to each other, how the gender roles work. So there is a sensitivity because we're trying to change.
Yeah, you're right, Jeff. You can't ignore this issue. I think this issue is a lot bigger than the game of Survivor. I've been listening very carefully to what everyone has said, and from my positionality with my gender, far be it from me to speak for women. What I can do as a man, I can give a little bit of advice as to how to hear these stories. When we're talking about harassment, when we're talking about discomfort, when we're talking about male entitlement, it behooves us all as men to take a step back and look at our own behavior and imagine that you had no idea that what you were doing was inappropriate, was making someone uncomfortable, and you believe women if they choose to bring that up, because it's difficult enough to do that in and of itself. We have a responsibility to hear women, listen to women, and believe women when they're ready to tell their stories.
And that was just more gold from Jamal this season.
He's great. I love him so much.
Yeah.
I love him so much. There was a lot of meat in terms of what Jamal said, so I'm going to try and break it down, and we'll see how good of a job I do. I kind of want to start off with that last point that he said in terms of what is our responsibility in terms of thinking about like survivors of sexual misconduct, survivors of sexual violence, survivors of relationship violence. It's everyone's responsibility, but I think it's not more important. It's especially important for men to hear this message of it's our responsibility to listen, to believe, to support anyone who comes forward about a report or a claim of misconduct that's happened to them. Mm-hmm. There are so many reasons. I won't get into them because there are a ton. I think on one of the slides we do for presentations, we had like 25 reasons at one point. But there are a lot of reasons why people, or a lot of barriers as to why people don't choose to come forward and tell their story. Mm-hmm. And so essentially, if there are so many reasons why people are not coming forward to tell their stories, when they choose to do so, it is that much more important to listen to them, to believe them, to affirm them, and to let them know that at the end of the day, it is not their fault and that you are someone who supports them, you will back them. And I think it's hard for men to do that because we are overwhelmingly not going to be victimized by these issues. And so we're less likely to have those firsthand experience of misconduct for us to be able to say, hey, I see this as something that is, you know, a problem in our society. And this is something that I'm going to be actively against. And so I think one piece of advice I would give to anyone out there, but particularly the men in the audience, would be like, well, what is something that I can do? If someone comes forward to you about some claim, some type of report of misconduct, just make sure that you support them, believe them, and affirm their experience. But moving forward into like this broader conversation, what Jamal said, I think one of the pieces that I kind of took away from that is thinking about how men are able to recognize these issues of, again, sexual misconduct, sexual harassment, and how they expand, right? I think one of the things that's difficult for us to recognize as men is how seemingly, I'll definitely use seemingly innocuous activity and instances can contribute into this broader conversation that we're having on sexual misconduct and relationship violence in particular. And so it's hard to potentially interpret how maybe a touch here or a pat on the head, how that can be perceived as being something that could constitute, you know, misconduct or harassment. Even if it is clear to the audience that it is something that is unwelcome. In real life, for example, if we're going to extend this conversation outside of Survivor, we don't get clips from the show. We don't get the entire backstory.
Right.
So we're never going to actually get all sides of a story unless you are an investigator or someone whose job it is to get all sides of a story. If you're someone who has someone come up to them and say, hey, this person touched me in a way and it made me feel weird. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that, right? That might be all you get. Mm-hmm. And I think even thinking about like Aaron, for example, I think that's a very clear sign of this.
Yeah.
I'm sure probably someone discussed this idea, maybe not in vivid detail, but brought this concept up to Aaron. And by the way, I'm not trying to attack any of the castaways on this show whatsoever.
Aaron did have a very heartfelt apology about his part in the episode the other night.
Absolutely. And I actually saw that. And so I'm not trying to attack any of the castaways because this is something that is just mirroring our society, and it is an ugly thing to like talk about, but this conversation is ugly. And so I think Survivor did do a okay job in like mirroring the ugliness and the messiness that these conversations can look like in real life.
Yeah.
But going back to like the nature of hand, right? I'm sure when someone probably brought this concept up to Aaron in some way, and he, in that moment, was like, it's listen, if Dad said something wrong, or if Kelly felt some type of way, I would know about it because someone would tell me. And that's not necessarily the way that these things happen all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And so part of our job in terms of thinking about men is to do some self-work and some self-education, and recognizing that these issues are not just issues that are important for men to talk about or men to take seriously because they affect women, but it's part of our, I like to say it's part of my idea as a public citizen to take issues that affect the broader public at large to heart. And so like part of it is doing like self-educational work, right? It's reading about these topics if you haven't before. One person that I like to recommend to people who are just getting interested in this type of work is like this an author called Jackson Katz. He does a lot of really good work looking at this, the blend between like societal ideas of masculinity as well as the issue of sexual violence and how they like connect, right? And he does it in a way that's very introductory. There's a documentary called Tough Guys. I know I'm kind of soliloquying, but essentially soliloquy, blah, that's like dreams. But
you're good. You're good.
Cool. But essentially, if there's someone out there that is interested on learning a little bit more about this idea of, oh, what is men's role in sexual violence prevention? Again, Jackson Katz is a person that I would often like be the first person I'd be like, go ahead and read a book from him. But if you don't want to read a book and if you don't want to spend all that time, then I guess I would just encourage you all, I would just encourage and just reiterate the point that Jamal said in terms of making sure that you are actively listening to the folks that are in your life when they come up to you, and taking... And not only taking those individual instances when people come up to you, but like taking those moments, internalizing them so that in the future you can build up more of a consciousness in order to translate that information that one person said to you to others. And so that we can make like a broader impact societally if we can begin to internalize messages and then change them into action. And that's really, really difficult. I'm gonna give you a chance to speak because I feel like I went on.
Well, I have questions for you. I want to know more about this. So in terms of what Jamal was saying about, you know, believe women when women come to you and they're talking about these things, that I do think that there is probably like a knee-jerk reaction to sort of say like, but it was probably nothing. I mean that he's just a touchy guy. Are you sure it was like this? Because, but the people who go through this this experience, you know, the men and the women who have this kind of unwanted touch, that people get like you don't ever come across like, hey, you know, somebody, you know, bumped into me on the elevator. Was that, you know, that the intent is felt by the recipient, right?
I'm not sure if I fully agree with that. That's all right.
Yeah, that's fine.
Perfect. Cool.
What do I know?
You know a lot, Rob. I've listened to you before. You've talked about these issues in a very effective way, which is why I specifically reached out to you. So, you know, don't be too hard on yourself. But I am probably going to disagree with a little bit of what you said in terms of I don't think people who experience violence, you use the term victim. I tend to use the term survivor, oddly enough. But so survivors who do experience violence, I don't think they... I don't think intent is really what matters, right? So I don't think, even thinking about like that first episode when Kelly went and talked to Dan, like I'm sure she approached him in that type of way in terms of a conversational way, one, because of the nature of the game, because of the fact that if she doesn't do it in a polite and cordial manner, she might face repercussions, which, by the way, translates into real life. But I also think that part of why she was able, I think part of the more important thing is the impact that's actually felt on someone. So essentially, like, it doesn't necessarily truly matter whether or not someone you know, recognizes that, oh, this person meant no harm by it. If someone does something to you and it makes you feel uncomfortable, the discomfort that you feel is what takes precedence. Mm. So the discomfort that Kelly felt at that moment is what should always take precedent. It doesn't necessarily always, because of a lot of the, again, social dynamics in terms of A, the game, but also, you know, there are social dynamics in real life that take precedence in terms of like thinking about positions of power that people have over you. But that impact is truly, I think, the thing that we should be, I think the impact is the thing that we should be paying most attention to. Because then if you pay attention to the impact, the intent of the person who's causing the violence, essentially, if they are thinking about, if they are having good intent and we are recognizing the impact that individuals feel, then their actions should change moving forward. Mm. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yes, yes. The person, the survivor of the contact, they might have had an experience that was earlier in their life, and somebody is doing something that they genuinely are not. They don't have ill intent, but it is an issue for them because of some other experience that they've had. So yeah, that I definitely can see why that intent is not the ultimate deciding factor in and why it might not be clear what the infringing party's intent might be.
Yeah, and it may not even be the fact that they had something happen previous in their lives. It could be the first time that someone was touched in a certain manner, and they know right then at that moment, it's just like, that's not for me. I think the intent does fully matter in terms of how we go about like approaching folks, right? So thinking about going back to like the Jamal, and it's a different example, but going to the Jamal and Jack conversation, right? Jack probably had no negative intention to give a racially charged comment to Jamal. I'm sure Jamal recognized that, and therefore his approach to Jack was to have that conversation, that dialogue, in a way that could be, that could educate Jack and have him not make comments like that in the future, which I'm sure, hopefully, knock on wood, it did. Mm-hmm. Similar with Kelly in terms of Dan, in terms of thinking about when she went up to him the first time, she assumed good intention of Dan and tried. I'm making a lot of assumptions right here, but based off of the action, I'm assuming that she at the very least thought, okay, probably has no idea what this is causing me, so therefore I'm going to take the responsibility to go up to him and let him know about the impact that he's causing. It's not her responsibility to do it, but she decided to do it because of most likely a lot of reasons in terms of the game, but maybe one of the reasons had to deal with the idea of assuming positive intention for Dan. And then we saw that after she comes, informs him, he persisted to do it. I think it somewhat mirrors this idea that if we focus so much on the intention of someone's actions, that is important in terms of how maybe we address the person to bring them into the conversation, so that we're not necessarily calling people out of a productive conversation, but we're bringing them into one in which they can be a part of advocating for the rights of survivors and people who experience the violence. So that is important. But at the end of the day, our first and foremost priority when thinking about, you know, how do we proceed with bringing about a culture change in terms of thinking about how are we making spaces safer for people who have or potentially have not or are more likely to experience forms of sexual misconduct. It begins with thinking about the impact that these individuals face in the real world, and then also thinking about the barriers they have to receiving assistance for them to see receiving help.
Do you have any advice in terms of, as a man, in terms of if you were going to have this type of a conversation with another man who you were concerned with his behavior, maybe you saw something that you thought was not that great, or you might have overheard the complaint where that mm-hmm. there is some question over, you know, whether this person is getting what the problem is. How would you approach that conversation with another man?
Right. So essentially you're asking if you overheard that someone has experienced, is feeling uncomfortable.
Or saw something that you feel like.
Yeah. So in terms of advice that I would give, I think one, it's very much a case by case scenario, depending on, I might say the, I don't want to say severity, because I think all of these things are very real and serious issues. But I think it's just thinking about like the level of danger or the level of harm someone might experience in the future. So I think one of the things that I would recommend is to first consult with someone else before you begin having those conversations. I love recommending therapy. I love if someone knows that there is like a confidential resource around them. So for students in particular, if there are therapists at your school, if there are resources like advocates or sexual assault like programs at your school, I would obviously recommend like consulting with them first, just to see, just to assess like the severity of future harm that someone might be getting into, right? So that would be like, if you have a resource, if you have a professional around you that you can consult ahead of time, that's the first thing that I would recommend. But I think overall, though, I think it's just important to, one, especially if you try to not to say particular details that will get someone in future harm. So if someone comes forward to you, right, and they disclose information about a particular instance, I think it's important to make sure that you keep whoever comes forward to you as you keep that the names or the personal identification of that individual as private as you possibly can, because you don't want that information to be directed towards someone. Because going back to at least to one of the barriers that people have about coming forward with their story is that there's a fear of retaliation. And so we want to minimize that fear as much as possible. But in terms of like engaging in that conversation with like another man or someone who might have caused harm in the future, I think it's important to just like talk about the actual actions that they are doing, and what the impact of those actions are, versus potentially labeling someone as being blank, because that goes to, back to the idea of it casts them out from this conversation, or at the very least it places a label on them that they will not be receptive to hearing anything else that you say moving forward, because it's almost like this idea of like, if you label them, then they're labeling you as someone who is like, oh, they have all this assumptions of me, and therefore why should I even bother listening to them? And it's annoying that you have to coddle, you know, men when talking about sexual violence, but yeah, like, unfortunately, I don't think you have to, but yeah. I think when thinking about like the initial level of entry in terms of this conversation, like sometimes there's some coddling that happens, and I hate it. But moving forward, so like try not to label someone, try and talk about the specific actions that are happening. So like in this instance, to go back to it, you might say, hey, listen, I saw that you, I noticed that you like touched Kelly's hair, and I know she came up to me in the past and was just like, oh, I don't like it when people touch my hair, so I just wanted to let you know ahead of time, like that might be something that you want to, you know, cut out, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not saying something like, Kelly came up to me and told me that you're freaking her out, stop it, stop being such a like a creep, right? You're not labeling, you're not saying that the person who's experiencing harm came up to you and said they were experiencing harm. You're just saying that you noticed something, and that it might be harmful, that you might want to stop. And then that will potentially open the door in terms of, you know, if they have good intent, that might be a way of them being like, oh, I had no idea, I'll totally stop, no problem. Even if they have bad intent, they might do that too, so you never know. But at the very least, like if they have questions on it, that opens the door to having that dialogue of future questions in terms of talking about why, you know, a non-consensual touch of the hair is something that is important to address and important for us to take seriously. So again, I don't have a lot of advice in terms of like the actual meat of the conversation, but I have a lot of advice in terms of like how to begin those conversations, especially with someone who might be resistant to hearing you. So yeah.
Lemoyne, did you have any specific thoughts in the way that the show handled this situation once the initial complaints were lodged from Kelly?
I have a lot of thoughts. I think, first off, I'm going to commend the show, because I think they did a I think in comparing this from like the Tangania situation from Thailand,
come a long way.
To this, we've come such a long way. Additionally, this instance shows that we have a much further way that we need to go.
Was not perfect.
It's not perfect. And we're still learning. But I commend the show from just looking at how far they've come in projecting this issue to the audience. One of the things I do respect is that they didn't. And one of the things that I had like a little critique about the season so far is that they liked to tie up a lot of these social issues with a nice bow. Jack and Jamal ended with a hug. It was a nice bow. It was settled. The tribal council in the previous episode to this one, where they were talking about issues of gender, a nice bow, settled, done. We can all hug and go home. Mm-hmm. In the real world, in particular, talking about sexual misconduct, it's complicated. It's tricky. It's messy. It's not clear. And I think the show did as well of a job as they could to show why it isn't an issue that gets a nice bow at the end, even if they tried to do so at the final tribal council. So I'll commend the show for, one, addressing the issue with seriousness, and two, trying to make sure that they showed as much sides of the societal issue when talking about this issue of sexual violence and sexual misconduct in particular for this one. I think they did a good job of showing the complexity of it. So in terms of talking about where they might have somewhere to go, I've listened to the previous podcast. I agree with the point overall that's been mentioned in terms of, I do believe Dan should have been removed from the show. Especially once like they have Kelly talking with Dan on her own, which is not something that should be like her responsibility, but she took that upon herself. Be having all the extended evidence of Dan, inappropriately touching the contestants, following that initial warning from a contestant themselves. I think that was enough to, at the very least, maybe not like a warning, but there has to be like some sort. I think this entire instance just show that there needs to be some sort of like system set in place, to handle what happens when a castaway violates rules of conduct, and not just physical conduct in terms of fighting, but now we have to incorporate like what does it mean when a castaway violates some sort of rule of sexual misconduct. Mm-hmm. There is no system, there is no structure that is in place for that right now, and I think that's one of the things that, like, I know there's a large response for the audience in terms of, and I know that you have had your thoughts on that yourself, Rob, on you know, what does that process look like? But there needs to be one. And I think this instance just showed at this point, like, that's a huge gap that's missing on the show. And so, yeah, I think that Dan definitely should have been removed, both for his sake, the show's sake, Kelly's sake, the Sakasway sake. It just made sense for everyone to just be like, listen,
yeah,
this ain't the move. Let's peace. I agree with that fully. And now it just becomes, not only what's the methodology for castaways what's the methodologies for castaways when they do mess up the rules, but also like what is the system in place to prepare these castaways or to educate these castaways on these issues before they even get out there. You would know more about that than me, Rob, in terms of being a castaway yourself. But like,
yeah, I played Survivor in a very different time in the world than in Survivor, so right. I don't necessarily know that. It sounds like from the interview that Jeff Probst had done, I believe, with Dalton Ross, that there was a sort of like a reset of the rules of like, hey, don't respect bathroom breaks, and because I'm sure that it's come up in the past where people are trying to use the bathroom and then are looking for idols, and so I don't know at the beginning of the game, if that's under a heading of, hey, just remember to, I doubt that there was any sort of like a respect personal space sort of speech before the start of the game. But I do think that should be incorporated to what they do. And I think that there, you know, should be like blatantly clear, like there is a zero tolerance policy
yep.
on this type of stuff. And, you know, I don't know if like a formal complaint should need to be lodged. I kind of feel like that at the point where Kelly says she's uncomfortable in the beginning yep. of the game. And she's yep. doing confessionals with Bruce, hey, I'm uncomfortable. Like the, you know, that should be the warning, especially because in the real world, I could almost understand more of like, well, you know, it's her word against his and, you know, I don't know, like due process, but we have the video of so much of this. And I don't know if they had all of these videos at the time or if it was the result of, like, you know, logging all the tapes. And then we found all this like incriminating footage of like Dan in the shelter with Missy. But it just seems like that you had enough there to at least say, OK, we're just going to, you know, draw a line in the sand on this.
I also wonder, and this is just me, but I'm drawn back to the interview you did with Cass in terms of thinking about like how there has to be more diversity on production. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there were people with more targeted gender identities, so women or gender nonconforming folks. I wonder if they were behind production and if they were behind the cameras and saw the things that were happening with Dan. I wonder if there would have been more of a proactive measure in terms of being like, hey, we saw that Kelly already talked to him about this behavior, then we see this continuing conversations or these continuing acts, as well as we see like Missy talking about this in the confessional. I think we need to have a conversation before one of the castaways mm-hmm. is breaking down in a confessional. Yeah. I do think this is like thinking about Survivor in a systemic level. I think that the need for greater diversity behind the cameras is also an added component because when thinking about, and this goes into the entire like model of bystander intervention, which is all about the idea of you see something, do something. I think one of the things that like I've noticed like the podcast focused so much on is like the idea of like, oh, what should have production done? What should production have done? The first thing production needs to be able to do is be able to see the problems at hand. I'm not trying to go after production, especially as someone who would love to be on the show one day. But at the end of the day, I think one of the issues that's, you know, if the production is predominantly men and men are not being victimized by these forms of misconduct, then it makes sense why men are generally unable to interpret these instances of inappropriate touching as being problematic on a broader level. And so part of this conversation also includes, like, again, the diversity of production. So I would include that in this overall narrative of what happened here in terms of, yeah, let's get some more voices in the room and let's get some more eyes on the island so that that is also a systemic way that they can help protect castaways moving forward. Because I also wonder if there was greater diversity on production, if Dan would have felt as comfortable
mm-hmm.
doing the things that he did. I don't know if that's the case or not.
Yeah.
Who knows? But I think it wouldn't hurt it.
Right. All right, Lemoyne, any other thoughts that you want to share with our listeners pertaining to this wider conversation about what happened this week?
So the Me Too movement was founded by an activist by the name of Tarana Burke. And that's really important to know because she was focusing on the experiences of young Black women in particular. And so one of the reasons why I would like the audience to know this in particular is that, you know, when we're talking about this particular instance, it's not solely... It is a gender-based issue, but there are also a lot of other components that are involved in this, one of them also being race. And so the fact that Kelly is, you know, a woman of color, particularly identifying as Asian, there are a lot of other complexities to this conversation that haven't necessarily been brought up yet. And then also thinking about how we are talking about this conversation in terms of putting it into the context of Me Too, I do think it's important to make sure that your listeners are aware of like where Me Too really began. And it began because, you know, young Black women felt like their experiences were being silenced. And to see that silencing happen, like, you know, symbolically on Survivor when Kelly wasn't allowed to share her story at that second tribal council, right, just made me really think a lot about like the roots of the people who really started this movement. And so that's why it's like our responsibility to make sure that we, you know, as men, as women, as just a society, just make sure that we are listening to survivors of sexual misconduct, sexual violence, relationship violence. Make sure we're listening to them, hearing their experiences, and doing our best to uplift them forward. So if that's like the final message that I can give to your audience as a member of this audience, that's the message I'm going to give.
Okay, well, Lemoyne, I really appreciate all your contributions today. Do you want to point people to anything that you're doing online or any resources?
Nothing I'm doing online, but I will point to resources, which, by the way, I think Survivor probably should have had that at the end or at probably the start of the episode.
Yeah, I was talking with a friend of mine about this, and that he said that seemed like a no-brainer that they whiffed on.
That's a big no-brainer. So the minute they had those like second title cards in particular, they should have had the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network, also known as RAIN, their national hotline number, available for members of the audience.
And I think the reason why they boxed themselves in to not being able to do that is because that they left the person who was at the center of this in the game.
Yep.
I think it's very hard to do that and then say, and then tune in next week to see what this guy's up to next time.
Yep. They put themselves in the box. It's going to be hard for them to get out of it. I wish them luck at it, really. But I also wish like the audience members of the audience who, you know, did experience some triggering from this experience, I hope that they get some healing as well, whatever that may look like for you. So if it is you doing a resource, I would direct you all specifically to the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network, RAIN. They have the National Sexual Violence Hotline available on their website. Additionally, there is the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. So that's nsvrc.org. They have a directory to resources available at every state. So if there's someone who wanted to get in touch with a more local resource, I would check out that directory as well if you wanted to potentially seek out services or just ask questions as someone who, you know, has someone in their life that you might be supporting who's been affected by sexual misconduct, relationship violence, sexual violence. That's a great resource that I'd just like to give if I'm doing broad scale presentations. But yeah, additionally, you know, if you ever did want to reach out, if you're a patron, I am in the Patreon group. Feel free to shoot me a DM. Love to talk to you further. And yeah, that's all I got, Rob.
Lemoyne, thank you so much. I really appreciated all this. And then thank you for jumping in and making yourself available to us to be able to talk about this very important conversation.
My pleasure, Rob. You know, I always wanted to talk to you. You're my favorite Survivor castaway. Unfortunately, I wish I could have talked to you on a little bit more of a lighter topic.
Well, maybe next time.
Maybe next time. We'll see. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
All right, Lemoyne. Thank you again, and all the best. All right. Thank you again to Lemoyne and to Tori, who made some time to talk with me about everything that they saw going on in terms of this Survivor episode and how it might be possible to at least raise some awareness around these issues based on what we had happen, this very unfortunate scenario that we've watched play out on Survivor and in the social media over these last couple of days. And I really am glad that we're able to use this platform to be able to, you know, raise some awareness and hopefully have some positivity come out of this whole situation that has come up out of Survivor. Okay. Thank you guys so much for listening. I really appreciate a lot of the positive feedback that I've gotten over these last couple of days. And thank you again for everything that people have shared with me personally and in our Facebook groups. And really appreciate how open everybody has been. And I do hope that people do feel a little bit more connected because of all of these different podcasts and this conversation that's been going on over these last couple of days. So thank you again for listening. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.